Andre Agassi retired from tennis in 2006, leaving behind one of the best records in modern times, including 8 Grand Slam titles. Throughout his career, Agassi was never just another great player. He was a showman from early on, turning heads with his skin-tight denim shorts, not to mention his blistering shots. Later on, he slumped, badly. Then, somehow, managed to climb back on top of the tennis world and became the game's elder statesman. It's a complicated story, Agassi tells in his candid memoir titled Open, which the New York Times has called one of the most passionately anti-sports books ever written by a superstar athlete. Steve Paulson has played tennis his whole life, and he's always followed Agassi's career with great interest. So he was surprised to learn about Agassi's bitterness toward the sport that made him famous.
On the very first page of your book, you say you hate tennis. You hate it with a dark and secret passion. And throughout the book, you keep saying this to the people who become important in your life. And of course, no one believes you at first when you tell them that you hate tennis. So I guess I have to ask, do you still hate tennis now that you're retired?
No, I do not hate tennis. You know, people say, is it a love-hate relationship? I said, it's more like a hate-love relationship. You know, tennis was something I certainly didn't choose. I didn't choose as a young man. My father kind of pushed it on me. I felt fear to not do it, not in any sort of form of abuse, but in the form of just having the pressure of the world on my shoulders. He introduced me as the future number one player in the world. And then I went to an academy that I hated. It was more like a glorified prison camp, and then my only way out of there was to succeed. So then I succeeded and found myself on a world stage that scared the living daylights out of me, and all of a sudden I'm being judged for many things that I was and wasn't. So I never had ownership of tennis. I was scared later on, then I played because I didn't know what else I was going to do. And it wasn't probably till I was 27 years old that I took ownership of my choices and chose the very thing that I hadn't chosen my whole life. And when that happened, the scale started to get balanced. I started to understand what it was giving me, my school in Las Vegas that I built. It gave me my wife. And it made a lot more sense to me then.
Let me take you back to the early days that you write about with your father and how intense that was. I mean, you talk about how he groomed you to become the best player in the world. And he taught you some things that made you a great player, like learning to take the ball on the rise when you were 7 years old. How did he do that?
Well, he did that by inventing one of the gnarliest looking ball machines you've ever seen. And I nicknamed it the Dragon in the book because it stood in front of me fire breathing, you know, and he pushed that thing as close to the net as possible and had this long aluminum tube necking, and the thing would hold this ball in its throat until the pressure built up so much, and then it would fire out at about 110 miles an hour. And then he would kind of pace behind me back and forth, you know, a bit like a caged lion, kind of making sure I'm staying on the baseline and don't back up, don't let the ball play you, you play the ball, go after it, hit it harder, hit it earlier, you know. And so you learn fundamentals that allow you to deal with those sort of extremes. And as a result, you have the skill set to kind of adjust to the pace of tennis picking up as you get older, and was probably a huge reason for my success in between the lines.
So why do you think your father was so determined to turn you into a great player?
For him, you know, he's from what he calls the old country, and he didn't have a life of choice himself. And he, you know, grew up fighting the world, you know, getting a lot of fights as a kid because of being a Christian Armenian and a Muslim Tehran, getting in a lot of fights because his mother would make him wear hand-me-down girls' clothing as punishment. She was pretty abrasive, pretty abusive in many ways. And so he fought, and then he went into boxing because he realized he was good at it. And as a result, I think he's been fighting his whole life. It's just, you know, the world's against him, and he saw tennis as the quickest road to the American dream and wanted that for his kids. And he brought his intensities and his rage. I mean, anger was a way that he kind of reacted to a lot of things. If he didn't understand his own emotions, he would get upset. And I think that tennis reminded him of boxing without the downside of physical contact.
So were you afraid of your father when you were growing up?
I think you're afraid of any father at 7 years old when you're looking up at this man and you watch him knock somebody out in the middle of a street. You know, I wasn't afraid that he didn't love me. I wish his love was softer. I wish it was just a little less. You know, the intensity of his loyalties were unmistakable. The intensity of how much pride he took in me just has a real healthy power over a young young man growing up, but there's a real level of fear as it relates to, you know, watching your dad fight, seeing him get in fights. Also, too, just the mood of the house if you weren't winning or you weren't practicing well or hard enough or long enough. I mean, it fundamentally unsettled him. And when he was unsettled, everybody around him was unsettled.
Now, you were a Vegas kid, and once you started getting good, you hustled people for money as well. And you have a great story of Jim Brown, the old NFL great who shows up in Vegas and comes to your tennis club and is looking to play for money. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, it was at my racket club. We go walking into Cambridge Racket Club like we did on most days, and my dad points out Jim Brown, says, "You see who that man is? That's Jim Brown, one of the greatest football players of all time." And I was like, whoa, okay. And I'm looking at him, this big man, and he's talking to the manager of the club, who we knew pretty well, and he's upset that a money match fell through. The guy didn't show up, and he wanted somebody to play. He loved gambling. He loved tennis. And my dad steps in and says, "My son will play you." And he says, "If you're looking for a game." And he turns around and says, he kind of snickers and basically says, "You know, I'm looking to play for money." And I says, "Well, he'll play you for your whatever you want." And he says, "You know, I'm talking about real money." He says, "He'll play you for your effing house." And Jim Brown says, "I don't need your house. I got a house. What do you say we play for 10 grand? And says, "Let's go." And I mean, I'm starting to sweat. I'm just standing there, my eyes like saucers, like poker chips, you know. And Jim Brown says, "Not so fast. You need to go home and show me some money up front." And my dad says, "I'll be right back." And he gets in the car and leaves me there, which he used to do a lot of days when he had to go to work. I used to always be there. And Mr. Fong, the manager, used to look out for me. And I used to make sure I was out there practicing. And he comes back with our life savings, with his life savings. And when he shows it to Jim Brown, Mr. Fong is encouraging Jim Brown not to take the bet because he says, "This kid's going to beat you." And
how old were you at the time?
I was 8 years old.
Wow.
Maybe nine, just turned nine. So we go down on the court. He says, "I tell you what, let's play a couple sets and then we'll decide how much to bet." So, you know, I relax, but I kind of, I don't dog it a little bit. I just, not much pressure, but I'm still going to win. And I beat him the first couple sets and he's getting the feeling like this could be tough. But then he decides to bet me 500 for the third set. He thinks I'm probably pretty tired. I'm 9 years old. He's been running me around and I end up beating him worse in the third set. And, never felt so good. When he shook my hand, man, his hand was huge and rough with calluses.
You know, it's a great story, but on the other hand, you were 8 years old or 9 years old. Your father was putting incredible pressure on you. I mean, as you say, you know, betting his life savings on what you were going to do for him.
Yeah, but you know, if you really think about that through a different lens, you know, it's a real conflicting emotion because certainly that pressure feels unreasonable for any child. But at the same time, that pride, you know, that confidence, that belief that he had, it was a bit like a drug. It felt good to have a father that believed that much, but then it felt so bad because you almost wish he didn't, but then you're glad he does. And it was a weird emotion for me.
Hmm. Now, you've talked about how you resented how your whole life had turned into tennis. But on the other hand, it was clear from very early on that you were incredibly gifted and I assume you must have taken pleasure in that skill and enjoyed winning all those tournaments that you did as a junior. Was there a big upside as well?
Well, I think soon you become identified with it, and I think a child winning anything finds some sense of satisfaction. But it was fleeting. You know, that feeling was fleeting. You were always faced with the next challenge. You know, in tennis, you win, and you can win 5 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. You can win 6 matches and lose one, and you're a loser. And you can win a tournament and have to play the next tournament and lose, and you're only as good as your last result. So there was always that never-ending kind of pressure that came along with it that seemed to carry the day at the end.
Now, you talked about then being sent off to a tennis academy, Nick Bollettieri's famous tennis academy. You became his most famous protege. You've described it as like prison camp or maybe boot camp. What was the hardest thing about being there?
Raising yourself, you know, not having any really role models, anybody to really steer, help you make decisions, help you understand things, being so far away from home. All those things were pretty tough. Being in a group of kids where it was like Lord of the Flies with tennis rackets. I mean, we raised ourselves. We determined the rules and the pecking orders, and we determined it any way we saw fit. You know, whether who was going to rebel the most, who won the match, how we did with each other on the tennis court tend to dictate how we dealt with each other off the court, which meant winning was the only way to kind of organizing your life, which came with its own pressures and resentments. And then there was just the fundamental practical life of it. It was a boot camp. It was 4 hours of school and 6 hours of tennis. It was that inverse ratio of tennis to school, you know, left you really having to say no to school because you're just too damn tired to even think about it after a while and even care about it.
You became a tennis prodigy, and then you turned professional really early. I mean, you were 16, and you quickly rose up through the rankings. You were labeled the next great hope of American tennis, which I'm sure must have been a burden. You were flashy. Your hair was long. You wore denim shorts. You hit the ball really hard. And then you did that famous commercial for Canon Camera where you say, "Image is everything." And that, of course, became the rap against you. Did you have any idea what kind of lasting damage that commercial would do to you, to your reputation?
I never thought I'd be 39 years old still talking about it. I'll tell you that much right now. But I quickly started to become aware that you're not going to shake that. I didn't know. But more than not knowing the damage it would do, I didn't know what the actual statement was. It's a weird thing. I was doing a commercial, and a girl that I had known my whole life who had just come back from college, and she looked so beautiful when I saw her, and she showed up there, and I was thinking more about Wendy than I was thinking about what some guy wants me to say into a camera lens. And when I get done, she even asked me what that was all about, and I said, "I don't know. It's just some line for a camera. It's images everywhere. They're taking images, and it's an image on the screen, and you know, whatever." And certainly I came to regret that. It was a few months later that it became what I was identified with and what haunted me, whether I was doing well on the court or whether I wasn't.
And didn't reporters keep throwing that back at you? I mean, especially when you weren't doing so well, that you were all flash and no substance?
Yeah, reporters, peers, fans, you know, they would yell it from the audience if I was falling apart at the seams. They'd tell me, "That's all right, image is everything." You know, if I was winning, it was like the comments they'd make was always kind of built around this something that I just felt, you know, certainly wasn't what I wanted to be.
Now, you also talk about some of the top players you didn't especially like Boris Becker, who accused you at one point of, he said the Pro Tour was catering to you. He called you elitist, said that the other players didn't really like you. And this got really personal for you, didn't it?
And I didn't know how to deal with that. And one of the ways you can do it is to repress it. But what I chose to do with it that summer when he said those things was turn it into some anger, use anger as a motivator and focus on him. And, you know, there's no secrets between me and Boris as to what we went through, you know. But we had beers together late after he was retired, and we had good laughs about it because it's all pretty much juvenile, you know. It's long ago and juvenile in many respects, but it's one of those things that you have to tell because it left an indelible mark on me. What was really formative was how I channeled it and how I used it, and then how I didn't get over the line at the U.S. Open, and all this emotion and all this anger going 26-0 to that U.S. Open final and then losing to Pete, how all of that meant you were a loser. You're 26-1 and you feel like a loser, and that to me was a real meaningless kind of existence.
Now, what people always said about Pete Sampras is that he gave his whole life to tennis. He was 100% committed to tennis, and tennis was clearly not your whole life. You had tremendous ups and downs throughout your career. And I guess looking back, I mean, do you have any regrets about not dedicating yourself to tennis the way Sampras did?
No, I don't have regrets about that. I have regrets about a lot of things. You know, I'm glad I found my peace with tennis. That would have been a crime for things to have ended prematurely as it related to me appreciating the game and what it had given me. But winning and adding more titles, you know, I never identified with athletes who did that. It's not something I understood. At times during my career, I wished for his sense of clarity or his sense of focus or his lack of need for inspirations. But for me, it just wasn't in my DNA.
Andre Agassi, talking with Steve Paulson about his memoir called Open.